hardly a week goes by without some press report of some behaviour that has been genetically determined. I think the list is sort of ever-growing, really, in terms of what is claimed to be genetics: violent arson, infidelity, tendency to tease, being a couch potato, alcoholism, homelessness, exhibitionism, you name it, they say that it is in our genes. And many of these claims are created by reporters caught up in what I think is a fashion, really, of labelling anything as genetic. And the term that's used quite often now is it's in my DNA, and it's becoming so common, really, and I think it's something that we have to challenge, because even the most serious scientific claims are often later disproved, but of course disproving them doesn't appear in the popular press. And one of the most biggest and most sustained battlegrounds has been around the nature of intelligence, how it's measured, how it's defined, actually, how it's distributed amongst individuals, individual classes and races. And it's been really the focus of tons and tons of scientific and numerological facts and fantasy. And its history has been very, very connected to all the arguments about economics and politics. I think really it's a new slant on a very old argument. In previous class societies, for example, feudal society, the class divisions, the inequality and poverty were justified by the natural order of things. It was said that it was preordained by God. After the bourgeois revolutions, which were fought under the banner of liberty, fraternity and equality, that argument shifted. And the argument shifted to an argument that justified it because it's something that was natural, something that couldn't be changed. And I think that in more recent times, we've seen another shift, really. And that shift really has been to move the argument to justify inequality by science, really. Science as the legitimator under capitalism, that everything is determined by a pseudo-scientific explanation that everything that exists, including our intelligence, is genetic. And the current wave of determinism is part of a massive technical advance that's taken place in terms of genetics in the last couple of decades. But it also, it's not just about that really, it reflects both the social and economic crisis inside of society and growing inequalities between rich and poor, which exposes the reality of capitalism. And really, in order to hold that society together, there has to be an explanation, an ideology that is put forward, and that ideology that they are now using, really. In the past was the natural order of things, now it's down to our genetics. And if you look at the battleground that's going on in terms of the teaching methods today with Gove, you can see that this is one of the big arguments that are taking place. And I want to go back a bit to some of the history of the stuff around intelligence and intelligence testing. And this was first developed by a French psychologist, Alfred Binet, a century ago. And his aim was really to identify children who were having difficulty in schools and who would benefit from additional help in terms of education programmes. Binet attempted to identify intellectual tasks that on average children of a particular age in a given cultural environment could be expected to perform. And children whose mental age was more than 2 years lower than that, than their chronological age, were deemed to need special help in terms of education. And Binet's view was that with the rare exceptions of individuals who were suffering from the brain damage or something like that, that all children could perform well in school if given the appropriate resources and support. So in other words, he rejected really the whole notion that a person's intellectual level is something fixed and unchanging. And his IQ test was really a diagnostic instrument so that intervention could take place to raise a child's intelligence. And he says we must protest against and react against the brutal pessimism contained in the idea that people's intelligence was fixed. And indeed, there's two Belgium investigators noted that the children they had studied had much higher mental ages. And Binet says of the Belgian children, well, not surprising really, they attended a private school, they came from the upper social classes, their school had smaller class sizes, and these children had a completely different culture at home. So he just completely dismisses this stuff. However, after Binet died in 1911, his ideas were exported to the United States of America and to Britain. But those people who exported his ideas exported it with a completely different set of ideological ideas. It was exported by the Galtonian eugenicists, so named really after Francis Galton, who was Darwin's cousin, who took control of the mental testing movement and used it really as a tool to justify his political ideas. And these eugenicists hijacked works of Charles Darwin and used a mechanical interpretation of his work, I would argue. They jumped upon the term survival of the fittest to apply not just to the natural world, but to apply it to human societies as well. And they are often, and I would argue wrongly, called the social Darwinists, because actually if you look at Darwin's works, originally he didn't talk about survival of the fittest. He talked about natural selection, but he changed it in the fifth edition. And the reason he changed it was because using the term natural selection allowed God to come back into the equation. He thought if you use survival of the fittest, that this will take God back out of the equation. Little did he know what would happen as a consequence. Francis Galton argued that intelligence is inherited and attempted to prove it by tracing the histories of famous English families. He founded the eugenics movement, which campaigned for selective breeding to be imposed on the human race. His ideas, of course, were taken up enthusiastically by scientists all the world, but particularly in America and in Germany. And we know the results of it. In the United States of America, thousands of people were compulsory, sterilised in an attempt to wipe out what was labelled as feeble-mindedness. And of course, we all know the logical conclusion of what happened in Germany with the Nazis' justification for the Holocaust. So that was the way in which the eugenicists' ideas were moved. In the United States of America, the testing movement was advanced by a man called Louis Terman, who invented the Stanford Binet test and the term intelligence quotient, IQ. And this refers to the ratio of mental age to actual age and established a measurement scale with 100 representing the average performance. And he claimed that this IQ was not just a useful diagnostic tool for school children, but a measure of general intelligence abilities for everybody, full stop. And he really relentlessly promoted that hereditarian view of intelligence, even though his own data revealed a very, very weak correlation between social status and IQ. But this is what Terman argues, really. Firstly, practically all of his investigations, which have been made of the influence of nature and nurture on mental performance, agree to attribute it far more to original endowment than the environment. This is what he believes. And he argues that common observation, note the words, would itself suggest that the social class to which the family belongs depends less on chance than on the parents' native qualities of intellect and character. The children of successful and cultured parents test higher than children from wretched and ignorant families for the simple reason that their heredity is better. So, working class written off as idiots, according to this man. But these tests really showed glaring social and cultural bias, such as requiring the knowledge of tennis, bowling. So, and this is the kind of thing they used, really. And one of his examples was the IQ of 20 children in a Californian orphanage, and he said it was low. And he attributed this to the fact that most were children of inferior social classes. He didn't even consider the alternative explanation, the idea that, you know, children are in an orphanage, that they're separated from their family, that this might be a traumatic experience for these children. That doesn't really enter it. He says that it was a very stimulating environment and therefore they should have been of the same intelligence, and this really told you that it was about some innate intelligence. And you can see where this man comes from, because he warned in 1919 individuals with IQ of 70 to 85 would drift easily into the ranks of antisocial or join the ranks of the Bolsheviks. So there you are, this is what, which brilliant actually. Right, so that's America. In Britain, the IQ test was first popularised by Cyril Burt, who's an educationist psychologist and one of the most those responsible for devising the 11 plus test. And he streamed kids in. It was about streaming kids really into factories. It was about replicating the existing class divisions, and that's, you know, that was his sole reason for being. Burke claimed that his 40 years of research proved a child's intelligence was mainly inherited from his parents, and that social circumstances played only a minor role. And his research really formed the basis of education policy for half a century, from the 1920s until the 1970s. So incredibly influential in terms of what his ideas said. And yet, only a year after his death in 1971, evidence began to emerge that Burke was a complete fraudster who had simply invented concepts to fit his theories about hereditability of intelligence. Burke based his arguments on twin studies. The twin studies are an attempt to really isolate some innate core of intelligence from the complexity of your upbringing and your experience. And one of the reasons that Burke's studies were so often quoted, because it claimed that there was no similarity between these identical twins and the social circumstances of the families that they were raised in, which were separate, and that's why they took note of these arguments. However, such cases are incredibly rare, and in previous studies, only up to 20 pairs of twins had been found. Burke's studies stood out because he claimed that he found 53 pairs of twins, and Burke also showed that these were extremely high hereditability of 80% for IQ performance when he studied these twins, or so he said, because actually later it materialised that even the people who were supposed to be investigating these twins, his assistants, didn't even exist. And really his studies were a complete and utter falsity. They were a flaw. A liar and a fraud was what Leon Kamin's verdict in his book was. Of Burt, and even Burt's biographer Leslie Hernshaw was forced to accept that the charges of fraud were justified. But that don't let that stop people coming forward, because they'll still come forward with the same old nonsense. And it's important, really, the exposure of Burt as a fraudster was an enormous significance to the movement to get rid of the 11 plus and selective education, and to replace them with a comprehensive system. And the result of that shift was a vast improvement in education for many children across the country. But the argument won't go away. And in the 1990s, people may have heard of the bell curve, which Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein, where they tried to link intelligence to race. They argued that inequalities in society are all due to the difference in inherited capabilities. And if blacks and Latinos are poor, if they do not do well at school, if they are more likely to be in prison, it is all down to their genes. And again, they say that this is due to inheritance rather than an inadequate education system. And again, the purpose of this study that was put forward and this book that was put forward was to argue against the politics at the time. It was to argue against spending money on welfare or an affirmative action schemes, because these people are programmed to fail, they argued, and that's why they put these arguments forward. Now, apart from all the evidence that shows that even in terms of IQ tests, that that these can be shifted by intervention. I think one of the big problems with this study is really the assumption that race is a biological useful category. The racial groups into which we commonly divide people as black or white or Asian or Latino do not really correspond to any biological division in genetic terms. The Marxist biologist Richard Lewontin demonstrated in the 1970s that there is much more genetic variation within such groups than there is between them. It doesn't make sense in terms of a biological argument. It's nonsense. But this sorry history has been told many times, and it doesn't matter. They still continue to outgrow what I think is really an intellectual corpse and should have been long ago buried, but it comes back because of political reasons. And in the 70s and later years, tests that were more culturally fair have been developed, but they continue to ask the children to make judgments about class and acceptable social behaviour, and therefore there's still a problem with all of these tests that are put forward. And Some do imperfectly measure capabilities that can be reasonably associated with intelligence, such as information comprehension and certain kinds of abstract reasoning and problem solving. But most of them really don't tell us very much at all. The tests really are elastic. So in the 1930s, it became clear that girls were performing better than boys on some items. So the tests were adjusted to make sure it brought it back to 100. No such adjustment, of course, was ever made in terms of class or in terms of race. So, you know, this is complete nonsense, isn't it? And it's the same really today with university marking, because it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because they still use these curves, and they still use the argument that really 10% will fail and 10% will get a first, and the rest of the people will be distributed on that curve. And so I suppose the point for me really that the tests are essentially social, not biological instruments. They adapt to the goals of the testers, and I think that's really worth bearing in mind. Neuroscientists like Stephen Rose see many distinct brain processes, motivation, perception, memory and more, and underlying how students respond to any of these kind of tests. And it could be argued that what they test is the ability of people to take tests, and that's what I would really argue is the case. And I think we have to say, what is intelligence? In fact, the two ideas most commonly associated with intelligence by experts are ability to adapt to one's environment and ability to learn. And the traditional IQ tests are not designed to measure either of these capacities. And since intelligence really encompasses a variety of distinct capacities, it's highly unlikely that overall intelligence can be meaningfully measured on a singular linear rank, as if we're like in heights really, which is how they want to put it. And whatever IQ test measures, it's not something unchangeable, fixed forever, an individual genetic inheritance. And the clearest evidence of this is what was called the Flynn effect. James Flynn looked at IQ scores, and he saw that they have steadily and significantly increased since the first tests were devised, and that's why periodically they're brought back to 100. And I mean, if you look back, you know, people who would have done really well in the past would now do quite badly, so that's why they shifted them around, really. I think that since the 1990s, there's been really a new dimension to the debate with the development of genetics. In the 1990s, we saw the plan for the Human Genome Project being laid down, and it claimed that it's going to set up a DNA data bank to link the health records of the entire population with their DNA, to identify disease genes and develop personalised medicine. Sorry, I'm just wondering where the time's at, actually. How long have I been speaking for now?
Just under 20 minutes.
And behind this, really, I think, has laid the failure to recognise the sheer complexity of humans as biological beings, shaped both by evolutionary and social history. The reductionist view was demonstrated by Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, which was published in 1976. And it's just really one example of a type of reasoning, first known as social biology, and more recently as evolutionary psychology, which continues really to dominate popular science writing about evolution. I mean, I've got books by Daniel Dennett, Steven Pinker, loads of other people who really follow in this kind of tradition. And Dawkins says that the fundamental unit of selection is the gene, the unit of heredity, and selection occurs at only one lowest level, the gene. And people may know his famous quote, and he says, "We are survival machines, robot vehicles, blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes." And in what was called by the press the Darwin Wars, Stephen Jay Gould argued that this is factually, scientifically, and logically wrong. It's not good enough, he insists, to say that adaptive evolution of organisms is linked to and correlated with the changing frequency of a particular genes in a population. The theory argues, in its classical Darwinian formulation, that the adaptive evolution of organisms is the causal result of interaction between organisms and the environment. This is what Darwin argues. It's an interaction with their environment. Genes, Gould insists, are generally not the thing that intervenes directly with the environment. They are therefore not the causal agent, and so not the unit of natural selection. And it is the organism that interacts with the environment, and the organism that is therefore the unit of selection. And the key point in Gould's argument is that natural selection is a theory of cause, not simple correlation. And I think that that's right, and that's part of the problem, really. It's looking at something and then saying that that's what it is. It's a bit like the common sense stuff that we had earlier on. By the 1930s, really, we saw the completion of the Human Genome Project, the international mission to decode all the DNA information in our genes. And it's worth looking at the claims that were made about it. Sir John Sulston of the Sanger Centre near Cambridge, who led the project in Britain, said, "We are going to hold in our hands the set of instructions to make a human being." Lord Sainsbury, who was the British Science Minister at the time, "We now have the possibility of achieving all we ever hoped for from medicine." And Daniel Cosland, who was the editor of Science, declared that the basis for illness such as manic depression, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia and heart disease would all be unravelled with a new drug treatment for these conditions that would surely follow on. And the project cost something like $3.6 billion, making it the most expensive biological project in history, and produced a result which really shocked many of the scientists. The human body consists of some 40 trillion cells and some 100,000 different proteins, but only about 22,000 genes, which is roughly the same number as a fruit fly, and we share 50% of our DNA sequence with a banana. So quite clearly, that is not what determines what goes on, really. And so many claims, really, have been made about the Human Genome Project. And they're really based, their basis is fundamentally flawed. The problem is what are we investigating? And why are we investigating it? And who decides what we investigate? I, like Stephen Rose, feel that the areas of scientific investigation is determined by big business and big business interests. For Hillary and Stephen Rose, the big science that the Human Genome Project represents is dominated by industrial-sized labs, giant pharma companies, and government money. Thus, according to them, doing the most ambitious and most sophisticated research is no longer tied up with achievement, it's implicated very profoundly with money. John Parrington, who's in our organisation, and Stephen Rose both point to the importance of the profit motive, really, behind biomedical science, because this is the dominant motive within capitalism, and that's why the Human Genome Project came into existence. And if, as claimed, Human Genome Project primary aim was to identify gene variants linked to disease, it would have been better to have focused specifically on such variants rather than mapping and sequencing the whole of the genome. There is no way such a small number of genes could code for all of those proteins, let alone such complex behaviour as intelligence. And in fact, the majority of human characteristics and diseases, even if they show evidence of a hereditary component, do not follow simple rules, since they involve a number of different genes whose combined influence is incredibly complex. And I think underlying all these works, which attempt to explain our behaviour in terms of our genes, is the idea that we can understand society by reducing it down to its constituent parts. If society is violent, it's because individuals within the society are violent. If individuals are violent, it can be reduced down to the properties of their genes. And this is an example of that kind of reductionist logic. Now, that might be all right when you're looking at nature, but it's not all right when you come down to a complexity of human society. I think that human beings are the result of a very complex dialectical interaction between internal chemistry and the environment in which they live. And those two can't be separated. If you baked a cake, You cannot argue that the proportion of the sponge are 30% due to the flour, 30% due to the fat, and 30% due to the sugar. The final product is a result of the chemical combination of the ingredients which occur during baking, and therefore we have to have the two sides of it. This is not an argument about nurture versus nature. It's an argument about understanding what really takes place. But bad science and worse politics have never got in the way of this kind of argument. I just want to end really by saying that under the Tories there has been a massive increase in the momentum around this argument again. And the first public signs of the re-emergence of this was last October 2013, when a report by Dominic Cummings, one of Gove's advisors, was leaked to the press. And in it, Cummings attacked the British education system for failing both the brightest and the least able students. For Cummings, teachers are part of the problem, but much of it is also down to the failure to tune education to the genetic potential of individual students. I don't know if people saw Boris Johnson and his argument about the cornflakes on the top of the bowl. You know, this is how these people talk about people. They're the people who we should be creaming off so we can compete with China. This is what their argument is all about. And so the battle lines really are being drawn in terms of education. And they're trying to roll the clock back to the days of the 11 plus really, because that's what their game is about. And Gove is interested, Gove's intent is on fighting the influence of progressive ideas in education. It simply doesn't fit really with the Tory values to have working class children educated in critical thought, in problem solving, in creativity. They don't want any of that nonsense really. And his mission is really to destroy the idea of child-centred comprehensive education. He wants to destroy the idea that education should be life enriching, where all subjects and interests are open and available to all people. And really, for all the talk of raising standards for all, he's not really interested in that at all. Gove's mission is one where the majority of children are taught to know their place, compounded by his addiction to testing at an ever earlier age. So the testing, baseline tests at the age of 4, phonic tests at the age of 6, all of this stuff really is about weeding working class kids out so that you can select the best people off the top, the people who come from the richest backgrounds, because that's what will happen, and that's what he is trying to do. And that means we have a fight. We have a fight on our hands, right? And I think this week, at the end of next week, the demonstration on the 10th by the teachers and the government workers and all the rest of it is incredibly important, because to me, the teachers aren't just going on strike around the question of their pay and pensions. Actually, they're going on strike about the whole question of the future of education. And, you know, that's why I think it's so important today.
Thank you, Maxine. I'm going to open the meeting now for any